This morning's reading is Genesis chapter 23. Genesis chapter 23. Sarah lived to be 127 years old. She died at Kiriath Arba, which is Hebron, in the land of Canaan. And Abraham went to mourn for Sarah and to weep over her. Then Abraham rose from beside his dead wife and spoke to the Hittites. He said, "I am an alien and a stranger among you. Sell me some property for a burial site here, so that I can bury my dead." The Hittites replied to Abraham, "Sir, listen to us. You are a mighty prince among us. Bury your dead in the choicest of our tombs. None of us will refuse you his tomb for burying your dead." Then Abram rose and bowed down before the people of the land, the Hittites. He said to them, "If you are willing to let me bury my dead, then listen to me and intercede with Ephron, son of Zohar, on my behalf, so that he will sell me the cave of Machpelah, which belongs to him and is at the end of his field. Ask him to sell it to me for the full price as a burial site among you." Ephron the Hittite was sitting among his people, and he replied to Abraham in the hearing of all the Hittites who had come to the gate of his city. "No, my lord," he said, "listen to me. I give you the field, and I give you the cave that is in it. I give it to you in the presence of my people. Bury your dead." Again, Abraham bowed down before the people of the land, and he said to Ephron in their hearing, "Listen to me, if you will. I will pay the price of the field. Accept it from me, so that I can bury my dead there." Ephron answered Abraham, "Listen to me, my lord. The land is worth 400 shekels of silver. But what is that between me and you? Bury your dead." Abraham agreed to Ephron's terms and weighed out for him the price he had named in the hearing of the Hittites, 400 shekels of silver, according to the weight current among the merchants. So Ephron's field in Machpelah near Mamre, both the field and the cave in it, with all the trees within the borders of the field, was legally made over to Abraham as his property, in the presence of all the Hittites who had come to the gate of the city. Afterwards, Abraham buried his wife Sarah in the cave in the field of Machpelah near Mamre, which is at Hebron, in the land of Canaan. So the field and the cave in it were legally made over to Abraham by the Hittites as a burial site. Amen.
Thank you, Margaret. Oh, good morning. It's good to see you. About 10, 15 years ago, we were going on holiday to France, and we were camping down the eastern side of France or something like that. And I decided that we would, as part of the journey, go to visit my great-uncle James's grave. Great-uncle James was in the First World War. He survived the Battle of the Somme, but then he was killed in a skirmish battle later on. He's buried in a little town, a tiny little village town called Erquingham, which is near Lille, right on the French border. But in order to kind of get an understanding of Great-uncle James, I borrowed the family scrapbook and sat down with my youngest daughter, Caris. We'd only be about 9 or 10 at the time. We just sat on the settee and began to read through the scrapbook. And we got to Great-uncle James' page, and there's an obituary, a story about Great-uncle James in the Lancaster Guardian from 1918, I think it is. And as I read it, it spoke more about this man as a Christian than it did about him being a soldier. And his captain, who'd written the letter to his grandparents, just wrote and said what an upright and a godly Christian man he was. And I had no relationship with Great Uncle James. He was just like, Great Uncle James, he died in the First World War. But that morning, or that day, as I read this out to Caris, I got halfway through. And then suddenly, it just slammed into me that three, four generations on, we were sat there enjoying the Christian heritage that had been laid down for us as a foundation, and that I was a part of him, and Caris was, and he was a part of us. And I just broke my heart. And I wept for this man I never, ever knew. And Catherine had to finish reading the obituary because I couldn't do it. About 15 years ago, sat in that office one Monday morning with a couple of the guys who were on staff at the time, and we were talking about our past, and we're talking about family. And some of you know I'm from a big family. I'm one of seven. I've got five brothers and one sister. Actually, I had six brothers. Baby Christopher was born with a heart defect, and he only lived for 6 weeks. And I remember when he died, I remember crying, but I mean, I was about 8 or 9 at the time. I remember standing, singing over him when he was a baby asleep in his cot or his pram, because that's what I used to do. I used to sing over my brothers to wake them up. But then, kind of almost 40 years later, I was just sharing with two friends on staff and said, oh, I had a brother, Christopher, who died when he was 6. I said, never known him, never grown up with him or anything. One day I'll meet him in heaven. And I just in that moment, the floodgates opened and I bawled my eyes out. I'm like, where the heck did that come from? Now, grief is a pig. It really is. It's an animal that sneaks up on you and bites you and catches you so unawares that you think you're doing okay, and then a moment later you can find yourself dissolved into tears. And I just want us to look this morning, partly because it's Armistice Sunday and it's a day when we remember people who gave up their lives. That means they died for us. But also because sometimes it's a subject that, as a pastor, you've got to take your people to. So forgive me if you get a bit uncomfortable with that. But I just believe that there's a story here that Margaret's read to us that we can just understand some things from. It's not a three-point sermon, because some of the things in the Bible aren't written in three. But, well, most of them aren't. How people produce 3 points out of everything, I don't know, but some of them do. But anyway, let's just have a look at this story about Abraham and Sarah. I mean, first of all, they've been married for a long, 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 long time. I mean, how old was she when she died? 127. In those days, you got married young. So we're looking at this. This is a really long-lived marriage. And as you've read the story in Genesis, you can read different things about their life and their love, and sometimes some of the difficult things that they went through and some of the mistakes that Abraham clearly made. And Sarah clearly made too. But when she dies, there's just a verse that I just think is a permission-giving verse. It gives us permission to grieve. It says this: Abraham went to mourn for Sarah, and he rose and went to weep over her. And I just kind of think, when you look at that, first of all, that thought of mourning. In the ancient Near East, mourning could last a long, long time. It wasn't that they were morbid, it's just that they were honest and they were real about it. Even today, 2,000 years later on from Jesus' day, a Jewish family will, when a close relative dies, they sit Shiva, which can last for up to a year, where people will come and visit and remember the loved one who's gone before. Because they recognize that mourning is the beginning of a process. And for those of you who've lost loved ones, and I know many of you have, it's people who are so close to you that you know that it wasn't just something that, well, we had the funeral and the Thanksgiving service and it was lovely. The tea afterwards was great and met loads and loads of people. And I was so exhausted, and the day after I woke up and I was fine. It just doesn't work like that. It just catches us and it bites us and it gets under our skin. And there'll be moments when we think we're doing okay. and then just one flash memory, just one thought, or you walk past a photograph, or you do something that you used to always do together and now you can't because she's gone or he's gone. And the next moment you find yourself in tears and then kicking yourself because you're British and you've got to stiff up a lip. You're not like those Middle Eastern people or those Latin hot-blooded people who just bawl their eyes out in public for no apparent reason. And you fight against that pain of grief. But it's still pain. And it says that Abraham got up to mourn, but then he wept over her. And I just want to say this morning, it's okay to cry. Whenever I visit somebody who's lost a loved one, one of the things I do is I just deliberately say, do you know, I just want you to know it's all right to cry. Don't hold back the tears. You know, I have this thing, don't cry, don't cry. Or we get very uncomfortable sometimes when people are weeping in front of us. If you need to cry over someone who's died, then don't hold back the tears. You have our permission. You have God's permission. It's here. It's written big through the Psalms. It's okay. It's okay to cry. But then, not just the mourning which begins that process or weeping which expresses it, but Abraham then does this thing where he goes and he's got nowhere to bury Sarah. And I know some of us, we don't think about death. I know if you watch television during the day, which is usually because you've retired, you get these adverts where it says, have you thought about a pension plan? And then the next advert after is, have you thought about a life assurance plan? And the next one after is, have you thought about a death plan? And you get nice people like Sheila Hancock or Michael Parkinson, who are getting pretty close to it themselves, just as a reminder, they've been with you all your life, but they're going to go as well. And have you chosen your coffin yet? Those kind of adverts, you know. And have you put some money on the side? Because you don't want your children to have to pay for your burial, do you? Of course you do. You spent most of your money on them. Just let them cost you something at the end of it. But Abraham goes and buys this plot of land, and there's this beautiful courtesy, this ancient Near East courtesy, where there's this bargaining, where they say, first of all, Abraham, have the land. You're a prince among us, have the land. That doesn't mean they're going to give it free. It's just the beginning of a process. And it's, well, Abraham says, well, I'd like that plot of land. And the guy who owns that plot of land says, have the land. And Abraham says, no, no, I want to buy the land. And he says, well, if you want to buy the land's going to cost you 400. And Abraham says, that's fine, I'll pay for the land. So that became the family burial plot. But you know, sometimes for us, when somebody dies close to us, there's just a whole load of practical issues mixed in with the mourning, mixed in with the weeping. There's a death certificate. There's the undertakers to sort out. There's the service order because the pastor's going to come round and pester you for it. By the way, do you know one of the great joys that we have, sometimes Sue or Ian or myself, is to sit down with some of us here and plan a funeral service before you've died. It takes great courage and faith. But to know exactly what you'd like. Well, I want this hymn, I want that hymn, I want this song, I'd like this person to do a reading. It actually works so well, and it's a privilege for us to be able to do that and spend time looking at those hymns and those scriptures and to pray. And we keep it on file so that when you finally do pass, we know what your wishes were. Just think about it. So Abraham does this practical thing. And in the middle of the mess, in the middle of the mourning and the weeping, there's always loads of practical things to do. Who have I got to ring? Who needs to be told? Oh, there's great Uncle Fred and he's in Australia. Will he want to come home? Because his brother's passed away. And all those kind of things. And so you're caught up in this kind of mixture of, well, times when you stop for a cup of tea and you find yourself sobbing into your brew. And the other times when you're busy, 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 and it's keeping you from thinking about what's happened. And time again, in the middle of that, people say to me, you know, Pastor, I can't believe how peaceful I am. And it's almost like in those moments, God's Spirit gives you a kind of almost spiritual adrenaline. So that you can walk through those weeks with His energy. But then there comes the time. And it's the time when settle down. All that practical stuff's out of the way and you're sat home alone. Or you begin to think, well, who am I now? I'm not a husband anymore. Who am I now? I'm not married anymore. Who am I now? I'm not a son anymore. Who am I now? What is life for me now I'm alone? Huge, huge life-changing challenges that actually only sometimes amplify the pain of grief. And Abraham and his son Isaac, we'll see in a moment or two, have to face that. There's a lady, I think her name's Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, and some of you who've done counselling training will know that there's a very famous kind of description of what they call a grief cycle that people go through. Now, the last thing you need if you're grieving is somebody to be able to say to you, well, do you know there's a grief cycle and you're about to get on it? And you're going to ride it, and it's going to take you through all these phases, and you can tick them off. It doesn't work like that. I prefer to call it a grief jumble, because it doesn't work in order. It doesn't work in a pattern. They're just things that people have observed, and this lady put them down and said, look, there's this kind of general pattern. And the first part of that would simply be that when somebody dies, we have denial. You know, when somebody dies, somebody will go, no! And just that struggle to believe that it's actually happened. That's very normal. That's why it's been observed and said a lot of people go through a phase where they just can't accept. They almost live as if their person is still living with them because there's this phase of denial. Sometimes there's anger. Why? Why has it happened? Why have I been left alone? Why didn't they do more? Why should this have happened to me? And that is such a painful phase. But it's a very normal thing to do, to feel angry about. Why have they left me? And then there's a reasoning or a bargaining. If only. I have a friend who I got to know him when his 48-year-old son died of throat cancer. And time again, he says, if only I could have done more. If only I could have done more. If only the doctors could have done more. If only they'd have found the disease in time. All the signs that they should have recognized that they didn't. That's a normal, if only, bargaining thing that some of us go through when we're experiencing the death of a loved one. Sometimes we'll experience powerful depression. The psalm that Jesus cried out on the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me, is a psalm of despair, a psalm of depression, a psalm of raw honesty and openness. And Jesus took that on himself as he died. And then there's acceptance, moving on. Beginning to make new plans, beginning to think, well, what next? What has life got for me now? What is life about now I'm on my own, or now Dad's died, or now Mum's passed? What is life for me now? How do I move on from that? And that's the beginning of an acceptance. And can I just give you a rough timeline? For most of us, that whole painful process, and don't go back and say, Andrew says it takes 2 years. For most of us, it's a minimum of 2 years and the rest. Okay? Some of the pain we experience, some of the journey, it's not 6 days, it's not 6 weeks, it's not 6 months. This journey is a minimum of 2 years and the rest. And I know for talking to some of you who've lost loved ones years ago, you'll still say, you still sit down and experience that grief. I visit my friend, and it's now 15 or 16 years since his son passed. And it doesn't happen as often as it used to, but he still sits in his chair with a cup of tea, and I'll see his countenance change as the pain and the sting of death and grief takes a hold of him, and he just physically crumples in front of me because of that grief that's there that's so fierce, so hard. And it bites your soul, bites your heart. Don't kid yourself about this. That's why Paul called it death, where is your sting? I'll never forget Pastor Barry Walton, the founding pastor of this church, speaking at a funeral, and he said, don't ever think death is a friend. He said, we sometimes say, well, he's at peace now, or he's passed away. And we use words that somehow make it nice. And he said, never, ever forget this. Death is still our last enemy. And it's more an enemy for those of us who are left, as much as it may be for those who've gone before. So that's kind of the grief cycle. Denial, anger, reasoning, depression, acceptance. And as I say, sometimes for us, it's more of a jumble than a cycle. It's not neat. It's not kind of patterned. It doesn't work like that. But there is a time to move on. The Ecclesiastes writer gathers this saying, a famous saying, you know, the one about a time for every purpose under heaven. And part of that in Ecclesiastes 3 verse 4 says, there's a time to weep, a time to laugh, a time to mourn, a time to dance. There is a time to move on. And it's really interesting that a couple of chapters later, you find that the kind of the courtship of Isaac's wife, and as she's brought home to him from the far country, Isaac takes his wife, and the last verse of chapter 24, it says this, the servant told Isaac all that he had done, that he brought Rebekah back. And it says, Isaac brought her into the tent of his mother Sarah, and he married Rebekah. So she became his wife, and he loved her. I like it. It's a great story. If you like romantic stories, read this one. It's a cracker. So that's Genesis chapter 24 for your homework. Put your Mills and Boone down and read that this afternoon. But then there's this beautiful line as Isaac has taken his wife, note, to his mother's tent. So it's this kind of thing like, you know, look, there's your mum's tent, son. We're nomads. We wander in the desert. But there's your mum's tent. Use that as the chuppah. Use it as the marriage tent, which was kind of a custom in ancient Israel. So he uses that as the marriage tent. But listen to these words. So she, that's Rebekah, became his wife and he loved her. Isaac was comforted after his mother's death. Two chapters later from Sarah's death, Isaac is still dealing with mum's death, and actually finding love actually helped the mourning, grieving process. Now, that's not necessarily a recommendation. If somebody's died, go out and find love. Okay, I'm not saying that. All I'm showing you is that process keeps going on. And there'll be points where you turn the corner and you'll know you've moved on. And there's a point here when Isaac finds Rebekah, or the servant finds Rebekah, brings her home. It's a major turning point in grief for Isaac, that he's comforted in his mother's death because he falls in love. So how do we begin to take a hold of this for us today? As a recent Pixar movie, I'm tempted to show you a clip of it, but I should say go and get it or watch a DVD or something. It's about inside our heads. It's called Inside Out. And it's about us, the fact that we're ruled by emotions, but inside this girl's head, there are really people who are her emotions. So there's anger and sadness and fear and joy. And a lot of the movie's spent with joy trying to make everything okay. Inside the girl's head, she has to move home from a beautiful country side in America, and she has to move right into the heart of San Francisco, and she hates it. So you've got all these things going on in her head, but there's one emotion in her head called sadness, and there's these memory globes, and the joy's intent and joy's commitment in life is to make these memory globes glow with joy. That's all she wants to do. So everything that this girl does, joy makes sure that the memory globe glows with joy. And sadness comes along occasionally, and she'll just put her hand on the globe and the globe will start to darken. And she's banned from doing that. Joy just draws a circle in the girl's mind and says, you've got to stand inside that circle, sadness, and don't move out of it. But then sadness keeps moving out of it, and every time she touches a globe, it goes dark. And I don't want to spoil the film for you, but eventually joy comes to a place where she realizes that virtually everything in our life, whilst it can have a huge element of joy, may also, and sometimes will also, be tinged with sadness. And that's why you can laugh at the memory of a loved one and then cry, because the memories are tinged with joy and sadness. And actually, a balanced life, a beautiful life, will understand that sadness and sorrow are integral to who and how you are, every bit as much as somebody who's filled with joy. They're part and they're valuable to us. And we know that because we see it in Jesus. We see Jesus who had these friends and clearly enjoyed living with his friends, clearly enjoyed eating with them, walking with them, talking with them, sharing life, doing life together. But then there's those moments in his life where he's confronted by death. Even in John's gospel, the good news of Jesus in John, where one of his friends, Lazarus, has died. And the sisters of Lazarus, Mary and Martha, come and say, Lord, if only, what's that bargaining thing in the grief cycle? If only you'd have been here, this wouldn't have happened. And Jesus said, I'm the resurrection of the life. Yes, we know you are. I am the resurrection of the life. Yes, we know you are. On the last day, we know that. But what about now? Because he's dead. There's not much resurrection and life about him. And Jesus sees the pain. And he sees the grief that's taken hold of these two sisters. And that incredibly famous, powerful, deep verse, Jesus wept. Jesus wept. And then he showed that this sting of death is broken in him. He showed, he demonstrated that he is the resurrection and the life. And that it's broken by him. It's broken because he brings Lazarus back to life. But it's broken because he died on the cross. And 3 days later, he became the resurrection and the life. He rose from the dead. And the joy of the good news of Jesus is that life is not just this 60 years, 66 years, 86, 96 years. It is about life in him, and the promise is that life in him begins now and is forever. Because way back in creation, death appeared because of the brokenness of our fall, of our rebellion. And the restoration of that happens at the cross and at the empty tomb. And Jesus is redeeming us. He's buying back the mess of death. He's buying back the pain of death, the sting of death, so we could know him forever. And he knew it too. There's a beautiful verse in Hebrews chapter 2 where it says, children, that's us, have flesh and blood. He, Jesus, shared in our humanity, so that by his death he might destroy him who has the power of death, that is the devil, and free those who all their lives were held in slavery by their fear of death. Wow. I don't know about you, but I definitely feared death. As a young man, I was a Cold War kid, and I believed that we would be annihilated by a nuclear bomb. And you might say, well, that was just silly, Andrew. It wasn't silly to me back then. I woke up with panic attacks in the middle of the night about it. I feared death. You know, when you trust Christ, when you trust in God, he is the resurrection and the life. You are meant to live forever as his disciple, as his follower. That's what he holds out to you in the resurrection. It's what he holds out to you through the cross, which takes away everything that's going to kill you. So you are free, clean, forgiven to live with him forever. Paul puts it like this in 1 Corinthians. Death has been swallowed up in victory. And I love it because you can feel him shaking his fist. Death has been swallowed up in victory. Where, O death, is your victory? Where, O death, is your sting? Thanks be to God. He gives us the victory through Jesus Christ, our Lord. And the beautiful verse is at the very end of the story. When you read the book of Revelation, it says that when he comes again, when he comes and makes everything new, he says he will wipe every tear from their eye. He says there will be no more death. There will be no more mourning or crying or pain, for the old order of things has passed away. And I wonder where you're at this morning. Just if you're in a place where you're still going through that incredible, what did we read about, as Sue read from Psalm 23, that valley of the shadow of death, where that's still looming across your life, still bringing tears or pain. Whatever you do, know that he knows. Know that he cried on the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me? Know that he knows what it's like to go through the valley of the shadow of death. Know that he will take your hand. And whether it's 2 years or 20 years, he will hold you through that. But know this, that you're not meant to die. You are not meant to die. John says that I wrote this John story of Jesus, the good news, the gospel of Jesus. I wrote this so that if you believe, you'll have life, and it will be eternal life in his name. Know that you can have that life in him. And maybe you've been coming to Fullwood for a while, and maybe this morning's a bit uncomfortable because you don't like talking about death and you wish this guy would shut up. Well, I'm going to. But I do want to challenge you. Because some of us don't think about death until we're dying. Some of us don't think about death till somebody close to us has died. But maybe this morning, it's time to do that. Maybe this morning, it's time for you to commit your life to Jesus Christ. And say, I realize that you made me for eternity. That your love and your heart towards me is that I don't suffer death. But I live life in you. And as a first step to do that this morning, then there's a prayer that you can pray. It will be on the screen. But in a moment of quietness, just to pray that prayer and see that's a beginning, a bit like a little toddler who's been crawling, taking baby steps. It's a first step towards Christ. But if that's for you this morning, then take that step. We're going to pray. Let's pray together. Just in the moment of quietness, give him your grief. Tell him how much it hurts. Don't be afraid of the pain. And ask him to be with you. Though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod, your staff, they comfort me. Keep a hold of him in the pain, in the mess, the heartache, the tears. Keep a hold of him who stands with you. And trust him. Trust him. Trust him. And don't be afraid to ask for prayer. Don't be afraid to ask for counsel. We're happy to spend time with you at the end of the service if that's right for you this morning. If you're in a place where you'd like to make that first step, then just in the quietness, pray the prayer on the screen. Lord Jesus, I know that you love me, and your death on the cross meant you took the punishment for sin, which I deserve. Please forgive me and clean me from all my guilt and shame. I confess you as the resurrected Lord of my life. I will follow you forever. Receive me as your child and fill me with the life-changing presence of your Spirit. Let's make that prayer your own prayer this morning.